Hello, and welcome to the 1840 podcast, where each month we explore a different topic balancing modern sensibilities with traditional sensitivities to give you new approaches to timeless Jewish ideas. I'm your host, David Beshefkin, and this month we're exploring censorship, that modern issue that keeps coming up, people crying, cancel culture, we can't share these ideas or this personality. We're talking about censorship, specifically in the Jewish world. This podcast is part of a larger exploration of those big, juicy Jewish ideas, so be sure to check out 1840.org, where you can find videos, articles, and recommended readings. There is an extraordinarily long history of censorship of Jewish ideas in Jewish books, and I think from the outset it's important to make a distinction that there are two directions where the pressure to censor or to, so to speak, cancel something comes from. Most of Jewish history has involved censorship from the non-Jewish community, people who didn't like the ideas in the Talmud, people who didn't like rabbinic ideas. There is a very long history of outside censors coming in to Jewish ideas and removing parts that they found objectionable. If I were to recommend one book on that topic, it would definitely be Amnon Raz. I'm going to mess up this last name. You could send letters. Amnon Raz. Don't make fun of me. Amnon Raz Krakotskin, whose book I have and I love, The Censor, the Editor, and the Text. It's one of many books that discover and discuss the idea of an outside censor coming in, a non-Jewish censor, and censoring Jewish ideas. This has taken place throughout Jewish history. An example that I always like to point out is the laws of conversion. If you look at the laws of conversion in a Shulchan Aruch, in an Aruch HaShulchan, in a compendium of Jewish law, you will find on top that says these are laws that are no longer relevant today. Why do they have that there? You can convert. You were able to convert the time that they were published. They were doing that primarily for the attention of the censor, to make sure that the censor understood that they were not going to be converting anybody, because for most of Jewish history, conversion was illegal in European countries, and they didn't want to get anybody in trouble. These are examples of censorship from the outside, but that is not the only form of censorship that the Jewish community has experienced. We've also experienced censorship from the inside, people censoring from within their own yeshiva, their own teachers, censoring their own works. Jews, so to speak, censoring themselves. Self-censorship, in a way. Self can mean the author themselves. It can mean their students. It can mean the publisher. A Jewish publisher says, this is not going to work. There is a wonderful article from Avi Noam Rosenick, and I'm airballing every single last name, called Hidden Diaries and New Discoveries, which discusses the life and thought of Rav Kook, specifically how his writings came to life. And he actually makes a fascinating distinction in the way Jewish ideas were censored from the inside. He makes a distinction between practical suppression and defensive suppression. Practical suppression is when we censored ideas because they weren't articulated properly. I would call that editing. This podcast is edited. I edit. You may not hear it. We'll see what Dina, our incredible audio engineer, chooses to keep in at the end. But very often I will say things, I will record things, and it just does not come out well. Today is definitely one of those days. But you can record something, you can write something, you can publish something, and there can be practical suppression. This is an idea that was not expressed artfully. What some politicians might call misspeaking. It just wasn't written in the right way. Maybe it was written better elsewhere, and it will be censored for that reason. But what we're really focusing on is defensive suppression. And that is when, whether it's the author themselves or their students, will censor ideas because they are so easily misunderstood, they are not yet ready to be shared with the public. And two very contemporary examples of this, one, which is what the article is about, is in the writings of Rav Kook, Rav Kook's famous student known as the Nazir, Rav David Cohen. Rav David Cohen censored the writings of his Rebbe, Rav Kook. How do we know this? Well, if you look carefully in certain passages, particularly there's a fairly well-known passage in, I believe, Oros HaKodesh, which is one of the books of Rav Kook, where you'll see there are like these little dots on top of the letter. And what are those dots signifying? Those dots are signifying, they're not the nekudos, the vowelization, it's just these random dots. And they are signifying the fact that part of the passage was censored. His students were concerned that the public, reading Rav Kook's writing, knowing the context of the way Rav Kook's ideas had already been received and the controversy that they caused, he was concerned that we need to excise this passage. We need to take it out because he is going to be persecuted. He is going to be canceled by the public reading it. They are not yet ready to read these examples. Another example of students censoring the words of their teacher is my teacher, who I've spent so much time studying, is Rav Tzadok HaKohen Melublin, the great Hasidic leader from 1823 to 1900. And my dear friend Josh Rosenfeld, who you might want to go out and Google this right now, because it's an absolutely wonderful article that he wrote on the history of the publication of his works, and he has this great table that literally tells you which passages were taken out. But you don't even need him to do it. If you go and you open up the first Hasidic work of Reb Tzadok, you will find that they skip. The numbers skip, depending what edition they have. They censor sometimes more, they censor sometimes a little bit less. But throughout that work, there were passages that were taken out because they were worried that the public would not properly be able to digest or understand. They would look at this teacher, these great ideas, and it would be distracting, so to speak. They would end up misunderstanding it, and the ideas would not be able to have the impact as they should. Now, for a lot of people hearing about this type of censorship, it can be unsettling. What does it mean that the ideas that we're having that were deemed worthy by the author themselves have been, you know, whitewashed or expunged from the very works? But I think any act of publishing and any act of sharing has some element of censorship involved with it. And it's a little bit what I think, and I'm going to push back on this. Not everybody may or may not agree with me, but I think the number one target that you see, certainly online in academics, they sometimes are very frustrated with the world of Art Scroll, which is what we're going to be spending a great deal talking about today. They're frustrated because in a lot of the history books and a lot of the biographies of Art Scroll, it seems that a lot of the gory details of these people's lives can be whitewashed. We don't hear that much about their struggles. We don't hear that much about what went wrong in these people's lives. And it's a criticism that in many ways is absolutely fair. The great Rav Yitzchak Huttner quite famously wrote in his 128th letter, which is undoubtedly his most famous letter, and if you've never read it, now is the time to find it. You can definitely find translations of it online. You can reach out to me. I'd be happy to share a translation with you. And he writes in his 128th letter that there is a problem with storytelling, with biographies in the Jewish community, that we read these biographies and we hear about these rabbis. They were 8 years old. They were geniuses. They were doing unbelievable things from a very young age. And it just seems like this very straight sequential path that they took towards greatness. And so much of the struggles, the example that Rav Huttner uses is the Chafetz Chaim. He says, we just talk about the Chafetz Chaim as if he was born pristine, perfect, great. But who shares the stories of the struggles and the difficulties that the Chafetz Chaim, this personality of Yisrael Meir Kagan, had to go through to achieve the saintliness that he is now renowned for? And I think that this is absolutely a remarkable point. I write about it in the introduction to my work, Synagogue, spelled S-I-N, for those who don't know, Synagogue, Sin and Failure in Jewish Thought. And I think Rav Huttner's talking about something specific in the life of the Chafetz Chaim that we know later on that the Chafetz Chaim did struggle, had depressive episodes that, you know, it's certainly not written in his standard biography. And Rav Huttner, who overlapped in the life of the Chafetz Chaim, I don't know whether or not they met. I don't think that they did, but I could be absolutely wrong on that. But Rav Huttner was pointing out the fact that we tell these pristine stories that can sometimes whitewash, censor, or almost cancel the very figures and values that were once acceptable or that were initially meant to be transmitted. However, With that being said, I do think that Art Scroll is unfairly identified in this. I happen to be very close friends. I work a great deal with Art Scroll, so I can disclose that. I didn't publish my books with Art Scroll, though one of them I tried, and I got a big, fat, juicy no thank you. Said with love, of course, always said with love. But I work all the time with Art Scroll, and I happen to think that they are unfairly positioned as this target, because you need to understand what it is in fact that they are trying to do. A lot of that we're going to discuss in this conversation with Jonathan Rosenblum, who has published several incredible biographies with Art Scroll, who's going to talk a little bit about his process, what he puts in, what he takes out, and some of his larger views on censorship and cancel culture. But specifically with Art Scroll, I want to say two things on the record. And I think the first thing has to do with not every story needs to be told to everyone. I think that this has to do with the familial component of Judaism and the familial relationship, so to speak, that we almost develop with previous generations. And the analogy that I often like to give is, what stories do you tell and share about your parents' marriage? Undoubtedly, every marriage is rocky. I am married. It's not falling apart, but every marriage has fights, has difficulties, has difficult times. But I don't agree that we need to sit down our children at a young age and talk about, you know, the difficulties that mommy and daddy had in their initial time, whether it was they were dating or their first year married or later on, whatever bickering or recurring issues that they may have had. I don't think parents need to sit down their children and air out every grievance that they've ever had. I think that when we initially share children those stories, we want them to have faith and trust in the context and in the marriage that brought them into the world. And I think in some ways, there is a space to tell such stories. I don't confuse those stories with history, but I also don't think that those stories are anti-history or uproot history. I think those stories serve a very important purpose, and I think in many ways this is the purpose of Art Scroll biographies. It's those stories that allow us to tell the story of previous generations, their marriages, so to speak, their commitment to the Jewish people, so to speak, which may have absolutely had dark spots and rough spots, but there is a space for certain ages, for certain demographics, graphics, that we tell more pristine stories. Now, that doesn't mean that we need to expunge the historical record. And I actually, my mindset and relationship with Art Scroll biographies, I've read all of them and enjoyed nearly all of them, but the one that I love the most, and I think really gives you an insight to what they are trying to do, what this Orthodox publishing house is trying to do, is the biography of the founder of Art Scroll, Rabbi Meir Zlotowitz. I think of any story that I've read in any biography ever published by Art Scroll, which are sometimes labeled hagiography, and I don't, so long as it's not meant derisively, I don't think that's a bad thing. But in the biography of the founder of Art Scroll, it gives you an insight. It almost undermines the very analogy that I said, and that is that there is a story that they share that most people don't know or aren't familiar with, that the founder of Art Scroll, Rabbi Meir Zlotowitz, was divorced. His marriage fell apart. It doesn't give all of the details, and I think rightfully so. But there's this incredibly moving story that right after the divorce, he came back extraordinarily depressed and tried to reach out to his Rebbe, Rav Moshe Feinstein. And when he came to Rav Moshe Feinstein to tell him what was going on in his life, Rav Moshe was crowded around by his students and he couldn't break through and talk to Rav Moshe. So he went home and put, started getting his kids to bed. It was a snowy day. It was in the winter. And as he's getting his kids ready, he heard a knock on the door, and it was Rav Moshe Feinstein. And I'll read directly from the biography, the Rosh Yeshiva, Posek, the decider of religious law of his generation and leader of thousands, accompanied his student up several flights of stairs, coming into the apartment and taking in the scene. Rav Moshe lifted one child, then the next, and finally the third one. He tucked each one into bed, telling them a story and kissing them goodnight. Then, when the house was settled, Rav Moshe looked at Rav Meir Zlotowitz, the founder, and said, "I came to Shmooze to hear what's on your mind." And I read this story and I say, I want this story in my life. It's a story that does tell you some of the friction that was going on in Rav Meir Zlotowitz's life, but that's not what it dwells on. It dwells on something else. It dwells on something that is incredibly inspiring. And the moment I read this story about the very founder of ArtScroll, I reoriented my feelings of ArtScroll biographies. I think that they do uplift. It's important not to confuse them necessarily. They're not PhDs necessarily. Some maybe could be, but not all of them are. And that's okay. And if you read them without that cynicism, without, you know, expecting one thing and getting another, but knowing exactly what they are and exactly what they're meant to accomplish, then it's not an act of censorship in the malicious sense, but it's an act of self-censorship, of sharing the areas and values that they are trying to reinforce and uplift. It is not trying to correct the historical record. And some of this we're going to share with and discuss with Rabbi Jonathan Rosenblum, who the entire interview I was so taken aback because he looks just like my father. In fact, if my father and Rav Herschel Schechter had a child together, it would look exactly like Jonathan Rosenblum, an analogy that I think none of our listeners will appreciate or care for, and I cannot blame you, but it was on my mind the entire time. So when we think about censorship, we need to think about what we self-censor, what don't we include from our own stories, in what context, what demographics, what ages do we tell which stories? And that's very much a part of our conversation today with Jonathan Rosenblum. I am very excited to be sitting here with Jonathan Rosenblum, somebody who I am excited. I usually call all of my guests friends, but over here, it's closer to my father because you look so similar to my father. It's really a spitting image.
Oh, come on. Your father wasn't that good looking. Come on.
But it's really, really a pleasure to be sitting together with you today. The reason why I am so excited to speak with you is, aside from being an extremely prolific author, specifically in op-eds in the Jerusalem Post for decades, you're also one of the great biographers of the Jewish community. You have written biographies on Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky, on Lieutenant Birnbaum, in a biography called They Called Him Mike, which you wrote with his family, I believe.
No. Lieutenant Birnbaum was done together with him based on tapes that he did.
With him, okay.
Yes, I did myself. Rav Dessler, I did myself.
Rav Dessler, you did yourself. And the great Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelovich,
right,
who was the Rebbe of my grandfather. So this feels very familial. And the reason why I wanted to talk about biographies and jump in is because biographies, I love your biographies. My father, as I mentioned, is quoted in a footnote in one, maybe even in the very text. He's definitely in the index.
Oh, yeah, the text for sure.
Of the Reb Scherer biography. Right. He was his doctor at the very end of his life and helped make some of those decisions at the very end. I grew up hearing his name. But very often biographies, even though they are beloved, do get criticized sometimes. Something you've written about, that criticism. They get criticized, a similar criticism, by two different populations. One population are people who are kind of outside or peripheral to the Orthodox world, who feel that the history presented in biographies is not accurate enough. You hear, you know, they were geniuses when they were 8 years old, and they were destined for greatness and for leadership. And it just seems, for the average person, it could be dispiriting. And it kind of can whitewash a lot of the real messiness of these people's lives. And the same criticism has been levied not by people peripheral to this world, but from the center of this world. The one person who does not have a great biography is Rav Yitzchak Huttner, the great Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin. You know, it appears in some places. There's no ArtScroll biography on him, and maybe you could have a little bit of insight for why.
That's easy to explain why there's no biography of Rav Yitzchak Huttner.
Tell me.
No one could deal with his daughter and son-in-law. I mean, it's just the family did not want a biography. I think the Rebbitson, who is an academically trained historian, if I'm not mistaken.
Sure, she wrote her PhD in Columbia on the Maharetz Chayes.
Okay, so fine. The Rebbitson had no one would get the permission of the family to do it. It's as simple as that. And they would make it unpleasant for anyone who tried to go ahead and do it without the permission of the family. The older Talmidim, the ones who knew Rav Huttner best, would not feel comfortable. Hillel Goldberg did write...
Correct, Between Berlin and Slobodka.
Not a full-length biography, but it's certainly, I would guess, 50 to 60 pages.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. It's phenomenal, and I recommend that, except it costs $300 because it's out of print. I think they just republished it, but it costs a fortune. It costs a fortune, and it's funny, you should know, somebody just asked me, I was being interviewed, and they said, who is your dream guest on the podcast? And I said, Rav Huttner's daughter, Rebbitson Buria David Huttner. She's number one on my list.
See, my I have a son who learned for 13 years by Rav Yonason.
That's Rav Huttner's son-in-law.
Yeah, Rav Yonason David. And yes, the Rebbitson, I'll give you an example. The Rebbitson is certainly very far reaching. One time I was debating Ephraim Zuroff on his book on the Vlad Hatzalah and so forth. It was a very hot room. It was mobbed. This was like in the Haredi intellectual circles or from intellectual circles, this was like Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. Not that it was much of a debate. I destroyed him, but okay.
Okay.
But when I got there, the Rebbitson was there waiting to get in. So I said, oh, I'm so glad that my oldest son who's learning in her husband's yeshiva didn't come with me. I wouldn't have wanted him to get in trouble when the Rebbitson showed up. She's definitely a very inquisitive, deep, broad-minded person. I can fully understand why she might well be here, but I don't think she'd be an easy interview.
No, not at all. Not at all. Not as pleasant as you.
Definitely not. Because she has too much to protect and too much at stake. And I have no yichus, I have no name, and I can talk as freely as I want.
So that's a great place to start. You have nothing to protect. Here's what I want to ask you about first, the process of writing a biography. When you write a biography, and you've published nearly all of them, you have a new biography coming out about Rav Noach Weinberg, the founder of HIV.
Oh, that's out already. That's out.
And we could talk about that.
You gotta read that.
Tell me a little bit about the process of a biography, and what is your goal in writing a biography?
Okay, those are two separate questions. The process is, since I'm a procrastinator, I like to interview people. I mean, interviewing through writing biographies, I've had access to so many people of a stature which I never would have had any opportunity to meet if I hadn't been writing these biographies. So, you know, that's always a pleasure. I mean, some of them have been different because, let's say in the Reb Yaakov book.
That's about Reb Yaakov Kamenetsky.
Right. Reb Noson Kamenetsky had done a lot of interviewing, and he gave me his interviews, many of which were at least partly in Yiddish, which I do not speak. So I had to get somebody to translate the Yiddish parts of those for me. But, you know, I had a lot of material was already gathered. I prefer to do the gathering of the material myself.
Well, before you gather materials, how do you decide who to write a biography on?
That's easy. Somebody comes to me and says, will you write a biography about so-and-so and this is how much we'll pay you? That's very easy. No one starts, you know, if it's good. The first book was Arts. I was very lucky. The first biography was Reb Yaakov. And at that time, I think Rabbi Shimon Finkelman was writing most of the biographies and he wasn't available in Art Scroll was sort of up a creek, and I had met Nelson Sherman through the Yet Ted Neman, which I was editing at the time, and they came to me. And now this will lead me to the second question, by the way. The second question is, what are you trying to do in a biography?
Yes.
So I have an introduction to the Reb Yaakov book. It's interesting because I went back to look at it. I started giving speeches on what Gadol biographies, what goes in, what doesn't go in, what and so forth and so on.
I'm just going to do the translation once. A gadol meaning a great leader of the Jewish community.
Right, right. So in the Reb Yaakov book, and I looked back and I wrote an introduction addressing the question of what this book should be, what it should be about, and it really pretty much stands up for everything I've written. The purpose of a biography is to show what was unique about that particular figure. So the idea of falling into a hagiographic mode where it's like the lives of the saints where at five he was this, and at 10, at five he knew all of Tanakh, at 10 he knew all of this, at 13 he married the daughter of the richest man in the world, and so forth. That was never a temptation for me because I wasn't trying to fit anybody into a model. For instance, I say at the beginning of the Rabbi Yaakov book, the psalkim, the
halachic rulings.
The halachic rulings that Rabbi Yaakov gave are not quoted here because they're meant to be definitive. It's enough that a figure of his stature said them. I'm not trying to do more than that. I'm not trying to tell anybody how they should live their lives or what is the proper psak for them. My feeling is if somebody's worth writing a biography about, he's worth presenting Kamoshehu as he was. One of the most beautiful treasure trove of information when I wrote about Rav Dessler is that I had dozens and dozens of letters that he wrote during the period of time when he was founding the Gateshead Kollel, which he was the initiator, or if not the initiator, the first head of that kollel. But most of his time was spent traveling all around England on trains at night, both to raise the money and to meet with former students of his. And he wrote a lot of letters back to Rav Zisher Waltner, the members of the kollel, to Rav Silman Sasson, who was his chief talmid, his chief student, was later asked to become the chief Sephardi rabbi of Israel. In other words, I had a lot of letters. You could see the person. The person came through as he was through these letters. So sometimes you find things that, you know, in some ways my favorite chapters in the Mike Tress book, it's a group of letters that I discovered in a file cabinet of soldiers who had written back to the Aguda during the war. They would get Pesach supplies, they would get some things from the Aguda, they would get Orthodox Youth, which was a magazine that was put out, and they could, and when they were in the DP camps, a lot of Jewish soldiers, Orthodox Jewish soldiers, wrote letters to Mike describing what it was like in the DP camps after the war and what the situation was and how the Germans, how the American soldiers, even after the war, were oftentimes favoring German girls and, you know, all kinds of things that you wouldn't have believed even after the war, that it wasn't so easy for the Jews in the DP camps and everybody wasn't always running out of their way to help them.
So how would you respond to somebody, you know, there's this genre called the art scroll biography and you're really at the center of it. And it's gotten a fair amount of criticism as whitewashing the real history as it's happened of the lives of these figures. So it's a two-part question, and you can respond, meaning, number one, did you do any whitewashing and why? And secondly, how would you respond to that accusation?
Okay, let me just tell you, there are very few things that really make me angry.
Is this one?
One of the things that does make me angry, a good friend of mine once wrote in an article of his in the Jewish Observer, he referred to the art scroll biography of Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelovitz. And I called him up, I got his name.
Well, he referred to it negatively, critically.
No. He just referred to something that the art scroll biography of Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelovitz.
Uh-huh.
I called him up. He didn't answer. I got his answering machine. I told him, Rav Aryeh, publishers do not write biographies. Authors write biographies. It is not the art scroll biography of Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelovitz. It's Yonason Rosenblum's biography of Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelovitz. Don't do that again. It's one of the things that drives me bonkers.
That's very fair. Meaning, instead of talking about this genre, if you have an issue, then take it up with the author, yeah, and, you know, not talking about it as if this monolithic genre called the art scroll biography.
I mean, this is a little bit gaivadic, but I don't think that this criticism has ever... I think when Rav Yaakov appeared on the scene, this is what I was told, that it sort of broke the mold, that this that it was different. I'm an academically trained historian, too, you should know. I mean, I started a graduate program at Yale when I was in law school in history. I was a history major in college. I wrote lots of long, long papers. I don't have a PhD. I don't even have a master's in history, but I have an academic background. So I have some concept of standards of historicity that, you know, I'm a little bit careful about this. Now, I will tell you that doesn't mean that everything always goes in, because first of all, it doesn't necessarily go in because you have a publisher and they may take things out. They rarely put things in, but they may take things out. I frankly cannot remember that much that has gone out of a book that I really missed tremendously. I can tell you
anything that you'd feel comfortable saying that was taken out?
A story I tried to get in three times. It's a story of Rav Lazer Gordon was giving a shir in Kovna, and the two great yeshivas, Rav Baruch Ber's yeshiva, which I think was called Beis Yitzhak, another one was called and the altar's shiva, was, I think it was called Beis Yisrael. I don't know which. They both all went to hear Rav Lazer Gordon's shir. They crossed the river from Slobodka in the Kovna, which was just across a bridge. And he started to give his shir. And as soon as, not long into his shir, Rav Aaron Cutler, who was, you know, the star of the Slobodka yeshiva, asked him a kasha. And he called him a shegetz. He started yelling at him, shegetz, shegetz, shegetz.
That's a derogatory term for somebody who's like not so religious.
Okay. Nagid. That's not, you're not going to get the joke if you say it like that. It means a non-Jew, okay? It means a non-Jew.
Yeah, keep going, keep going.
Okay, so yeah. Then Rav Shlomo Hyman, who was the star of the other base midrash, also asked a question. Rav Lazer Gordon started yelling at him, Ferd, Ferd, a Turk, Turk, Turk. So on the way back, it was known that according to how difficult the question was, that's how big the insult that Rav Lazer Gordon would give to the person while he tried to work out an answer to the question. So the two yeshivas were arguing back and forth who had gotten a worse insult, the one who was called a shegetz or the one who was called a Turk.
A Turk.
And they decided that Rav Shlomo Hyman had been insulted worse because a Turk is also a shegetz. It includes more. The shegetz what?
It's a double. It's worse.
Yeah. It's so it was a double insult. It was a shegetz plus, a shegetz and also a Turk. So that's a story that I wrote up. Nussin Sherman wrote, this story will not be understood in Peoria, and took it out. Now, I think he was right, right?
Yeah, he's probably right on that.
You're embarrassed for me to tell this story to you. You're probably going to cut it out of the interview yourself.
No, we're not going to cut it. No censorship of the censorship episode.
I tried to sneak it past Rav Nussin in another book. Because the story wasn't so germane, certainly not to Rav Yaakov. It was just funny to me because I realized in yeshivas that the old Lithuanians, my Rosh Hashiva's father had learned in Slobodka, the good Talmidim, they would insult sharply. They would never insult a weak Talmud, but if a good one asked a tough question, they would insult him. It was a compliment.
You worked closely, obviously, with Rav Nussin Kamenetsky because you did so many of his notes.
Actually not.
No, you didn't work so closely with him?
No, he read over the manuscript when it was done. We were friendly. I may have asked him questions about things that I didn't understand. We were friendly, but I wouldn't say we worked closely. No.
Were you surprised to the reaction when his biography, which is nearly unreadable, Making of a Gadol, 2 volumes, came out and got such pushback from within the community? Did that take you by surprise?
Well, you know, I don't, to this day, I got the first copy off the press. Rav Nussin came to my house and he brought me the first copy off the press. And frankly, you said it's almost unreadable, and I found it unreadable. I just
not almost.
I was once asked by some a Rebbe at Orson Math, how do we keep our students from reading this? And I said, let them try. I said, why should you worry about it? Let them try.
Exactly.
So to this day, honestly, I don't know why the book inspired such controversy. I think it only got Rav Yaakov up to the threshold of entering Slobodka Yeshiva. I think I've heard enough things in there that struck me as gnarish, you know, that they were a little bit silly. I was inclined to agree with Mark Shapiro, which I would have thought unlikely that I would agree about anything, that it's not history because there's no evaluation of sources. I knew that.
Uh-huh. It's just a collection.
I knew that it would be an unreadable book before it came out because Rav Nussin's son, who is a friend of mine, told me it's going to be a great book. My father has a very big vocabulary, and I thought to myself, "Oh wow, if that's a great book, then we're really in trouble." So I knew, and when he begins in the first sentence, "I am an autodidact," meaning a self-taught person, I knew that. And then you couldn't read the footnotes; they were in some weird Gothic print. And I had also dealt with Rav Nussin as the editor of Yated. I had brought some of his articles about some of his findings as articles, and they always had footnotes upon footnotes upon footnotes. I mean, each footnote had its own footnotes, which if it's unreadable in a book, it's certainly unreadable in a newspaper format. So I had some sense of the readability of the book.
So when you wrote your biographies, I mean, tell me a little bit more, because when you go on these interviews, do people ever tell you, you know, you can't publish this? Or how do you deal with the more divisive parts of people's lives? Like Rabbi Yaakov famously had a little bit of a dispute when he was in the yeshiva, Torah Vadas.
Okay, so I was going to talk about that. The only thing in any of the books that I could say with assurance would have rendered the book not something you could submit for your PhD thesis, right?
Yeah.
Because that's clear. The Machlokas in Torah Vadas is dealt with in one paragraph. It says that Rabbi Yaakov, there was a Machlokas in Torah Vadas, and Rabbi Yaakov was unwilling to risk the mitos that had taken a lifetime to build up, and he retired and moved to Muncie. And that's partly not true. It certainly, the Machlokas went on for a long enough time. I probably interviewed 25 people about the Machlokas, and I kind of agreed with Rav Hirsch Goldworm, Zekrit Tzadik Levracha, who was, I think, probably the first general editor of the Art School Shas, and had been in the yeshiva at the time, and a huge Talmud Chacham, and a very, very literate man in addition. And he told me it was a Maisa Satan. The Machlokas was a Maisa Satan. Somehow, and I don't know how exactly to translate it, but he said,
that's a tough, yeah, that is a tough term to translate. An isolated incident that other hands were at play. It was...
Other hands were also at play, but it wasn't only that. There was a, you know, Rav Mendel Weinbach once told me, he was very close to Rav Shore. He said Rav Shore didn't fit in because he was American trained. He was more Hasidish. He wasn't, he hadn't grown up in Schnippershook, which was, you know, a town outside of Vilna in Lithuania. He was by far too friendly with the Bachrim. You know, the Bachrim called him Georgie. He would catch cigarettes from the Bachrim. He was very easy with the Bachrim. There was a difference of personalities. There were, you know, but here's my point. If I'm going to get to Shemayim, do I really want to write about this? Am I going to get to Shemayim? And I've learned both Rav Yaakov Sforim and Rav Gedalia Shor's Sforim. They were both giants. Rav Gedalia Shor was considered the first great Torah scholar produced in America.
Sure.
Maybe the greatest. And he was a genius. And he was enormously influential on the Bachrim, much closer to the Bachrim than anybody else probably on the staff. Do I really want to get to Shemayim and say something definitive about a machlokas where I'm going to have to answer to either Reb Gedalia or to Reb Yaakov? I don't. Because I had 25 people I interviewed. Each had a different perspective. To say that there was some way of reconciling all the perspectives, there wasn't. And Art School wouldn't have published it anyhow, and I think rightly so.
So that's a great jump-off point to the topic at hand. And maybe you can help, but I'm curious what your approach is. There is a lot of attention being brought to the movement known as cancel culture, which inherently says there are some things that should not have a platform. There are some ideas, people, that should not be discussed or aired out. And I'm curious how you, who I assume for, you know, a host of political reasons, are not a fan of cancel culture. So what distinction do you make between, as a biographer, what you're doing, like kind of that subtle values-driven biographical education, versus the censorship that many people find ahistorical or undermining the historical record, or, you know, limiting what we're able to discuss, that we see taking place now in the secular world? How do you think these two phenomena are different?
When I write a biography, I am still subject to the rules of Lashon Hara. Before I'm a biographer, I'm a Orthodox Jew. I'm not permitted to say, and Rav Shimon Schwab has a famous article on this, right, that you're not exempt from the laws of Lashon Hara by the fact that you're writing a biography. It's not everything goes. If somebody, you know, if there was a marital tension, Lu Yitzur there was, it wouldn't be a proper subject for the biography. As a person who wants to write good biographies, honest biographies, the question you always have to ask yourself is, am I foreclosed by any limitations that might be imposed upon me from writing a biography that I can look at and say, I captured this person? So let me give you an example of a thing that I would have fought for and taken my name off the book, okay? This would really highlight your question.
Yeah.
In the Rav Noach book, on Rav Noach Weinberg, now famously, Rav Noach is the founder of a previous institution before Eish HaTorah, which was called Shema Yisrael. Shema Yisrael split in a very bitter fashion between, and Shema Yisrael became Or Sameach, and Rav Noach broke away or was evicted and went to the old city and created Eish HaTorah. This was undoubtedly a bitter parsha for the students who were in the institution at the time. It was like two parents divorcing, both of whom they loved. It was traumatic in every respect. The two other Rosh Hashivas who were my Rosh Hashivas, Rav Nota Schiller and Rav Mendel Weinbach, were among not to show it for sure, had been one of Rav Noach's lifelong closest friends and is somewhat of a disciple of his. So it was personally painful. It was just at the beginning of the Baal Tshuva movement when Rav Noach felt they were beginning to see some success. Now, I am, by the way, a product of Or Sameach. My tradition is not Eisha Torah. I don't know why I was asked. I asked them when they first came to me to write the biography. I
said, did you make a mistake?
I'm an Or Sameach guy.
This way people know that it's real. They can really believe it now.
Maybe that's what they said. That's actually one of the answers that they gave me, is that we'll have a lot more credibility coming from somebody who's not within the Eish family, because there are plenty of people in Eish who, they couldn't have written my biography, but they could have written a biography. Anyhow, the first publisher on this book, I had a chapter on this machlokas because I felt it was fundamental to establishing the nature of the Baal Tshuva movement. What were the principled battlegrounds between Rav Noach and on one side and Rav Schiller and Rav Weinbach on the other side? And I thought this was just essential to people who want to know the two major institutions, the two major Baal Tshuva yeshivas, to get a feel for them. And I worked on this very, very, very hard and showed it to a lot of friends of mine who happened to have been in the yeshiva at the time and who remember the split, to check it and so forth. The first publisher said, we don't deal with this kind of thing, machlokas. We don't want this chapter. I said, okay, but just, I don't want the book with you either. I'm not publishing this book without this chapter, and I will not have my name on a book.
Wow.
And there was another place in the book when I said,
I don't want to speculate who that first publisher is, but I did notice this is the only book that's, okay, not published with the previous publishers that you've done all your other biographies with. But they're friends. We're not, yeah, keep going.
Okay, so there was another place in there where the Eish people were upset, where I said Eisha Torah was not really a yeshiva in the traditional sense of the word. It was not based on Shar Dalet and Nefesh HaChaim by Rav Chaim of Volozhin, that, you know, the learning of Torah, it wasn't based on a concept of Torah.
Right. The traditional yeshiva structure with Torah.
The answer to every problem is learn more Torah. That was not Rav Noach's shita, and I said
his approach. Yeah,
and I had a sentence like that. It was never a yeshiva in a traditional sense. That drove people crazy too on the Eisha Torah side, because they were used to going to somebody's house as early Baal Tshuvas, and then somebody would say to them, "So what are you learning?" And they would say, "I'm memorizing the 613 mitzvahs." And then the people, even if the wife of the house, would say patronizingly, "Oh, that's very nice." It was like some sense that they weren't really yet in a yeshiva. They weren't doing something serious. They had a big Rav Noach felt, what's the point of teaching somebody Shnayim Oksim B'Talis? Two people come in based in holding a talis when they don't know if they want to be frum yet. You have to give them an overview. They have to know Chumash. They have to know Rambam. There were massive differences in the pedagogical approach. You couldn't leave that out. The very different institutions. I mean, even in the Rav Schuster biography, which is coming out next month, you know, he took people, he was happy to take people from one yeshiva to the other. If they weren't happy in one place, he would take them to the other. He made calculations about which yeshiva was better suited to which type of person. And he would not be budged from this. He would not work for either institution exclusively, because he felt that was dishonest to the people he was picking up at the Kotel. Anyhow, without this chapter, I just told him, no book. And Baruch Hashem, you know, we found a publisher who agreed with me. And by most people, it's Gil's student recently put up a note somebody sent to me saying he could not believe, he looked in the book to see how I would treat the machlokas, and he said he was absolutely astounded by how honest it was. Without that chapter, you can't have a serious biography of Rav Noach. That doesn't mean every personal foible of anybody that you ever wrote about has to be broadcast. But if it's fundamental to the portrait of who this person was, what his shitas were, if you can't do that, then you might as well not write it. That's my opinion.
Just to come back, what role do you, when you write a biography, do you look at it as the same, like, and you're writing biographies for people inside the community, do you think that the standard should be the same for academic history? What role, if at all, does, like, proper academic historical books, and by proper I don't mean yours are improper, but the goals seem to be different. So what role do you think that should play within our educational system.
I think I'd like people to get a sense of the period of time in which the person lived, that people are not just, you can't drop them down in any historical period without knowing something of the times, issues that were present in that time, understanding them in the context of their time. I'd like to be able to show any one of my books to any of my friends from the University of Chicago and Yale, and when they tell me they've read one of them, and some of them have, then I'm thrilled. When my father read the Rabbi Yaakov book, so he mentioned at the beginning, it was a little bit like reading Dostoevsky. It took him a while to get the hang of the names. But he said at the end of the book, he said, now I think I understand the choices that you and my wife had, that you and Judith, my wife, had made in becoming Frum. And that was, to me, that was a thrill. That was, I'd like my books to be readable by anybody. And I wanted to submit the, I would have submitted the Mike Tress book for a PhD thesis, to tell you the truth. I thought it was that good, and I thought it was of a standard that could have been submitted for a PhD thesis.
Talk a little bit about that before we wrap up. I know we've used a great deal of your time already. Tell me a little bit about that. Your father, your parents, they read your biographies, they loved it. Your parents and you grew up outside of the Orthodox community and later became Orthodox after following University of Chicago and Yale. How would you compare the freedom of inquiry within the religious community that you've become a part of and that which you grew up with? Meaning, I would guess, and what we're kind of like trying to what I'm trying to figure out is, are the cries against, woke, millennials saying, hey, we don't want to discuss this. We don't want this figure from the Civil War era. We don't want these monuments. Is that any different than the very healthy religious indoctrination? And indoctrination doesn't have to be a scary word that I grew up with. You didn't grow up with that. So what's the distinction that you see in the way that you grew up in the communities and the universities that you aligned yourself with, and now the religious community that you now find yourself to be a part of?
Okay, first of all, the universities I grew up with don't exist anymore. They simply do not exist. An Ivy League education for most of the students is not worth a hill of beans. I'm very happy with the education I had. I think it's maybe a better Torah Jew. I think it's given me an ability to access texts at a deeper level. I do think, by the way, let's say the Baalei Tshuva, people like me, the people who went to good universities, had a good secular background, we've made a big contribution to the Frum world. What I think may be one of the biggest contributions, who was eager to hear the Torah of Rav Moshe Shapiro? Who was prepared, who heard the idea of Keats, of negative capacity, the ability to hold two mutually exclusive ideas in your mind at the same time, could understand Torah, multi-leveled, multi-layered Torah like Rav Moshe, who created the audience for Rav Shapiro?
Yeah, you're referring to your Rebbe for our listeners, who is also somebody who I had the privilege to hear from.
But I think the greatest Jewish thinker of the last quarter of the 20th century, a preeminent Jewish thinker, a creative, massively creative, original thinker. We created an audience for that because we needed a Torah that was as sophisticated as the secular education. There's no sophistication in the secular education today. I didn't feel there was anything limited in terms of inquiry in the days when I was in college and in law school. We were all in favor of free speech, in favor of, the apocryphal phrase attributed to Voltaire, that I oppose your views, but I would fight to the death for your right to say them. Or a phrase that was much more poignant for me, Connor Cruz O'Brien is a writer I had read in college, who said, the definition of an intellectual is the one who can admit when another has made a point in a debate. By that standard, the number of intellectuals, the people who are capable of listening to another argument, of facing another argument, of relating to it and trying to rethink their thoughts. Now, this is something that we do in Torah learning all the time, all the time. You're supposed to learn Torah with a chavrusa. You're supposed to subject your interpretations to somebody else's. You're supposed to understand what is the distinction between what are the Rambam and the Ramban arguing about. If they think they're arguing, don't try and mush them all together. Figure out why they seem so heated about their debate. What is their debate? Now, this is something that Rav Natanael Wiederblank does so exceptionally, exceptionally well, and I'm attracted to that degree of classification. But what am I trying to do when I learn Torah? I pity the students who have never experienced the thrill of reading Tolstoy or Dostoevsky or Jane Austen or George Eliot, and who have never read deep history. I'm sorry for them because they've never known the intellectual intellectual thrill that that these works can bring one. But what I'm trying to do when I learn Torah is to connect to a Kadosh Baruch Hu. I want to understand Torah kamo shehi, which means there may be a lot of approaches. And I definitely think it's important, the fact that I have a background in literary studies, in real novels, not the deconstructionism and the modern academic apparatus that attaches to the study of literature. But in, you know, I read novels from the time, you know, I read hundreds and hundreds of novels. To understanding other people, you have to understand. Our sages tell us that everybody is different. Kamosha partsufeim shonim. As their faces are different, so deo seim shonim. Actually, we are open to the idea that people have different ways of viewing the world, that there is no one view of the world, that everybody has a unique mission that's based on his unique way of approaching the world. I don't find our world as so circumscribed, and to compare it to these little pishers of 18 years old who think they know everything and therefore no one can tell them anything, and they judge, they're not willing to expose themselves to anything other than what they already think by the time they get to college. As you know, as Robert George from Princeton told me recently, they come in indoctrinated. We don't have a, you know, we have no chance. They come in fully indoctrinated before they get to college. That has nothing to do with the modes of thinking that are required for high level of learning, for the approaching of a text at a serious level to know what this text says. You know, serious textual studies, an ability to analyze text, an ability to learn in Chavrusa and to be able to hear what somebody else is saying. I think, you know, I frankly think there are points of comparison in our community, and I think it's important for our community to develop a multitude of perspectives. You know, Cloud Perspectives, the magazine that I participated in for a number of years, was based on the idea that dealing with any of the sociological problems that face our community, the social problems that face our community, you need a multitude of perspectives to approach those. Policy making. I'm interested in policy making for our community. That's not necessarily based on simply learning Torah sources, but it can't be done by just learning Torah sources. What empirically would we need to know to approach these problems? But I find a lot of people who can think about these subjects and think about them in a serious fashion, they're not giving you rote answers or politically correct answers. They're trying to figure out, they're interested in facts. They're empirically based to some, to a large extent. I'm talking about social issues.
But, you know, allow me to play devil's advocate.
Yeah, I know you were going to do that.
You understand? I'm not coming. But, I mean, surely part of the policies that we put in place are meant to protect overexposure to certain things that are deemed to be either heretical or inappropriate or not in consonance with the values of our community. So why isn't that act of censorship? You know, I went to yeshiva, I grew up, it's not everything that's on the table, you know, and there are a lot of books, you know, you mentioned all these classics, you didn't necessarily grow up in this world. There are a lot of classics that are not necessarily read within the religious community for other reasons, not because of, you know, political issues or being PC, but because of being religiously correct.
They're prurient interests.
Correct. So how is protecting religious values any different? And maybe it's not, than protecting politically correct values.
It's very simple, David. If you go to a public schools, the indoctrination, as I said, starts now in elementary school, it starts in high school. These are public schools, right? A public school in the American system, we have an establishment clause that you shall establish no religion. The state shall establish no established religion, right? What they're doing is indoctrinating in a religion which is called wokeism and so on. That a public school has no right to do. Now, but the establishment clause doesn't prevent a parent from sending their child to a religious school to convey the values of that religion. Part of the problem is, and this is a crucial distinction, to the extent that my education in a religious school prepares me for my eventual life, either in learning or something else, it's a successful education. Education is supposed to prepare you for life. The education, the unwillingness to confront differing views or people of a different point of view, doesn't prepare you for life. They're not getting a functional education.
But let me ask you, and this will be my final question, and that was quite the take. Mm-hmm. My final question is, having kids growing up in yeshiva and within that world, and for the obvious reasons for why you do, and many religious families send their kids to yeshiva, do you ever lament or regret the level of education or the type of education that they get there? Or do you just say, even if you lament it, do you say it's a sacrifice that you are willing to make?
So I don't consider their education in yeshiva to be the entirety of their education. I have one son who has yaran and is also has a master's in child psychology. I have another son who spends most of his day learning physics classes from MIT. I supplemented their education. I wanted them to learn English. I wanted them to read. You know, my oldest son on his first date with his future wife asked her if she had read The Brothers Karamazov. And they grew up in a home where no one was going to stop them from reading The Brothers Karamazov, even though, do I think it should be part of the yeshiva curriculum? No, it's something apart. But I wanted them to have a richness, a sense of, you know, to read some great novels that would give you an ability to look into another person, to be able to understand another person more deeply than you would get from the regular, than you would get if you never done it. Now, today, there are authors. Now, Chaim Walder, for instance, is no Dostoevsky, but he has introduced into the reading world of from kids the ability to think about how does somebody else perceive the situation, to be sensitive to others and their needs and their pain and so forth and so on. You know, fiction, from fiction, has turned out to be a very good way of opening up social issues that might not be discussed in news articles and in columns, but it's become an outlet for discussions of lots of issues, which it's an interesting phenomenon, you know.
Yes, that world definitely has, even in the pages of like Mishpacha magazine or Ami magazine, they take on a lot. Yeah, they do take on a great deal of social issues that otherwise would, you know, people would be a little maybe afraid or unwilling to.
Yeah, and
discuss.
That's a very good way of doing it because I think it's a good way of doing it.
So let me close. We always close with three questions. We're going to go through them. I always want to know, do you have a book that you would recommend for somebody who wanted to understand more about the boundaries of values-driven religious education?
Nothing comes immediately to mind. I mean, I do think that the one book that I read by Rabbi Wiederblank, I mean, if you're interested in the boundaries of a religious education.
I have no problem. We'll recommend Rabbi Wiederblank, a former Chavrusa study partner of mine.
Wow.
And his book is absolutely wonderful. And we'll go with that as your answer. I want to be sensitive to your time.
I don't think it really addresses... I think his second book does, but I haven't read it yet. I haven't even received it yet.
It's phenomenal. I mean, they're real tomes, and he just did an absolutely incredible work. My second question is, if somebody gave you a great deal of money to either go back to school and get a PhD or to take a sabbatical and write any book that you wanted, what do you think the title would be?
David, I'm turning 70 in 3 months. If I were financially independent... I think I would spend more. I'd like to believe that I would spend more time learning at this point in my life, but I'm not even sure it would be. I don't think it would be a biography. I think it might well be on woke culture. It might be a book for the general world. You know, I still relate to that world enough that I want to have my say there. I think there are other people who are better qualified, bigger Talmidei Chachamim to. I don't think I have the great book of a primer in Judaism. I have too many friends who have done better. Jeremy Kagan, Akiva Tatz, Gabriel Rubin in some of his translations.
That's a rogues gallery of great books introducing to Judaism. Look, I have no problem with you saying you'll take the money and run. That's a perfectly fine answer.
Hey, I'll take the money and learn.
Take the money and learn. That's the...
But the problem is, you know, it's just interesting that I have a lot of things that I do want to say. And I want to say it. Rabbi Moshe Scheer was once described by Congressman Stephen Solers is that he was a bridge figure. He explained the outside world to frum people and explained frum people to the outside world. Because of my background as a Baal Tshuva, I somehow see that as in part my function in the world. I realized I have more articles that I want to write than my once-a-week column for Mishpacha. So I just sat down today and wrote 3,000 words for Yeted on the recent war, just because I want to, you know, bring my wide reading to people who are not going to read as much and to try and bring an analysis of what's going on to my, you know, to the frum world. So, you know, I have a lot of, I'm not lacking for things to write about, whether it would be in a book form or not, I don't know.
And it's a very noble cause, and I am one of your longtime readers.
I mean, I would still like to write a biography of Rav Moshe Shapiro, not a book about, specifically about his ideas, because I think I'm not that qualified in the Shirima right there.
But his life, we need that.
The diversity of groups upon whom he influenced. The remarkable diversity of between Russian ballet tshuvas, Israeli ballet tshuvas, how he pushed his Talmidim to do something in the world, to send Josh Hartman to head up Hasmonean school in England. And he pushed people to Rabbi Aaron Lopiansky to come to America and come a Rosh Hashiva in Silver Spring. Instead of just being in the Mir Beis Midrash, to go out and too oaf to do something in the world. That I would like to, I'd like to bring that out, yes.
I hope we see the light of that book one day. My final question I ask all of my guests is, what time do you go to sleep and what time do you wake up in the morning?
Well, that depends on a lot when my wife wants to go to sleep, to tell you the truth. But I will say that it is one of the discoveries of the COVID period. I discovered that I always thought I was a night person. I never got enough sleep, but I tend to fall asleep in the day. It's also probably sleep apnea too. I got through a whole year of law school without staying awake during one single class from beginning to end. I found that I'm happiest. The days when I'm happiest are the days I go to bed early, get up at 4 in the morning, and by the time I show up in the morning, Minyan have learned for 2 hours and I feel like I'm so ahead of everybody else. So I really cherish getting up early, turning on the lights when it's still dark outside, and sitting in my chair and reading. But that's what I discovered. I always thought I was a night person, and it turns out I can't write anything worth reading at night, but I do. But I can learn better, and my head is clear. Everything's clear in the morning.
I cannot thank you enough for taking the time out. It's really a double thank you for your time today, and hope we'll be bekesher, and just have a great day. Thank you again.
Bye-bye, Rav David.
I think Jonathan is or as he's known in some circle, Yonason Rosenblum, depending where he's writing, is a really fascinating figure because he chose this world. He didn't grow up in this world of being a biographer and writer, sharing the ideas of the Orthodox community in almost entirely Orthodox publications, though he wrote for a long time in the Jerusalem Post. But his books are primarily shared by Orthodox publishers. And I really find his writing to be fascinating because you really see in him somebody who is grappling with the values of the world that he came from, in higher education, University of Chicago, Yale Law School, and grappling with what intellectual freedom looked like in that world and what intellectual freedom looks like in the world of Torah, in the yeshiva world, in the Orthodox community. And I'm not sure I have it exactly clear, I'll be perfectly honest with you. I think both worlds have different ways of shaping and forming their values. I don't accuse either world, me personally, of any form of indoctrination. I think the very nature of community requires us to shape the values with which we share. And thank God, because of the just overload of information we have, you can choose. You can choose what stories you read to your children. You can choose what stories you access in your 20s. You can choose the deeper dive of history. All of this is at our fingertips. And if I were to give any piece of advice, instead of yelling and being frustrated at a biography or article or story or personality that you don't feel was shared in a way that you would want to read it, go ahead, do a little bit of research and find the historians or the ideas or the values that do reflect your worldview. But I think that there is a way, specifically now in the moment that we are in today with the gifts of modernity, that you can find something that reflects your particular traditional sensitivities and balance your modern sensibilities. So thank you so much for listening. It wouldn't be a Jewish podcast without a little bit of schnarring. So if you enjoyed this episode or any episode, please subscribe, rate, review, tell your friends about it. It really helps us reach new listeners and continue putting out great content. If you'd like to learn more about this topic or some of the other great ones we've covered, Be sure to check out 1840.org. That's the number 18, followed by the word 40, F-O-R-T-Y.org. You'll also find videos, articles, recommended reading. It's all there. Come visit. Thank you so much for listening, and stay curious, my friends.